This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the chief librarian at the Brooklyn Public Library, Nick Higgins. Brooklyn Public Library is the sixth largest in the country and is fighting back against the book banning that's been going on at a terrible pace.
We appreciate and reflect back on the life of publisher and attorney Bill Schaap.
In exposing the CIA, he did to the Central Intelligence Agency what Edward Snowden did to the NSA.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Authoritarian institutions and regimes ban and burn books. They tell people what they can and cannot read. The Catholic Church once banned the book by mathematician Johannes Kepler, which demonstrated that the Earth travels around the sun and not vice versa. Many of us know about the bonfires of banned books by the, quote, degenerate Jews, Sigmund Freud and Karl Marx, that the fascist Hitler regime lit with a frenzy. Can this happen in America? It's already started. Many state legislatures have moved to ban books. Some 250 titles have been put on a list of books that cannot be assigned to grade schoolers and high schoolers, including such classics in the American canon as To Kill a Mockingbird and even Catcher in the Rye. The censors don't want to encourage free spirits. They don't like criticism. For them, the ideal citizen does not think for himself or herself, keeps her mouth shut, and goes along. The Brooklyn Public Library is fighting for the rights of teenagers and young people to read what they like, discover themselves, and form their own opinions. The library launched a campaign called Books Unbanned in response to the increasingly coordinated and effective efforts to remove books from shelves which tackle a whole wide range of products, a whole wide range of topics. There were 1,597 individual book challenges last year, the highest in 20 years, since the American Library Association has been keeping track. The Brooklyn Public Library is the sixth largest library in the country. It started defending the right to read last April by giving free library cards to young people in every state in the nation. So far, 5,100 cards have been given out. 52,000 books or audiobooks have been checked out. The books that are most frequently challenged are those on sexuality and those on racism. We speak today with librarian Nick Higgins, the head librarian at the Brooklyn Public Library, who heads up their program. Nick Higgins, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
Let's talk about the situation and then what the Brooklyn Public Library is doing about it. What is the extent of the book banning, really book burning situation? How wide and how deep is it? And how long has it been going on?
Yeah, thanks, Michael, for the question. And thank you for the attention to what's happening across the United States with book banning and book challenges that librarians and schools are facing. It's an important topic. You know, really, we started paying attention more to it the beginning of last year in 2022, when we started to notice that there were reports from the field across the United States that libraries and schools were facing an increase in pressure from people in the community, elected officials, that wanted to come in and challenge certain titles that were on library shelves and make them inaccessible to students in those schools and those libraries. There was a big uptick. The American Library Association, the Office of Intellectual Freedom, who keeps track of the numbers of book bans and challenges across the United States every year, noted that there were something over 1,600 individual challenges and bans of books across libraries and schools across the country. PEN America, who keeps track of similar numbers and similar challenges and bans, came in a little bit higher of a number, but 1,600 by far exceeds any amount of book challenges that happened in the 20-year history of keeping track of this at the American Library Association. it caught people's attention. You know, really, it happens across all states in the United States. It happens in rural communities. It happens in larger metropolitan areas. And it's being fueled oftentimes by a coordinated effort of advocacy groups who come into usually pretty procedural and staid school board meetings, and in public comment parts of those meetings will, you know, cause a lot of disruption. They'll have lists of books that they deem pornographic or unsuitable for children to access and to read. Like I said, local and state elected officials are also getting in on this and driving some of the narrative on this by also creating lists of their own, asking their libraries and schools in their district to keep an eye on these books and report back to the state if they have those books in the collection. And it has a chilling effect on the whole profession, the profession of librarianship, but also educators who are at the business end of some of these attacks.
Well, Nick Higgins, you're the head librarian at the Brooklyn Public Library. It's the sixth largest library in America, and I understand that books about sexuality and race are the most targeted. Can you talk about some of the books that have been targeted?
Yeah, sure, and you're absolutely right. This is a new kind of book banning effort. I mean, we're a library. We have processes set up for members of the community to, you know, question the validity or importance of a book that they might find on their library shelves. It's an important part of being part of a a democratic society. We can engage in conversation about the ideas that we agree with, and also importantly about the ideas that we don't agree with. And there are processes in place, committees of librarians, professionals, administrators, school officials, who will receive those inquiries about particular titles, and there is a very deliberate process of reviewing any of the content in those books, reading the book cover to cover, making sure that we really consider the challenge to those books and its importance to the broader community of library users or students. But this time around, over the past couple of years, what we've noticed is the books that are being challenged aren't necessarily the ones that perhaps you or I experienced when we were going to school growing up, not the classics like, To Kill a Mockingbird or Catcher in the Rye. These are primarily focused on authors of color, books that contain protagonists and issues of LGBTQ+. Individuals, really books that and ideas that inspire conversation around race, racism, the history of America, and those are the books that are being targeted and singled out. You know, left off those lists are the ones that perhaps we're familiar about, the classics that oftentimes get held up as a book that gets challenged, whether it's Slaughterhouse-Five or Henry Miller book. These are particularly targeted at people of color and individuals and books, ideas, narratives that are exploring ideas of gender identity, sexuality, and race.
What's been the Brooklyn Public Library's response to this book banning, and what has been your role?
So what we decided to do was to try to intervene as a large public library system where there might not be so much support. So we know that we're a large library system. We're in Brooklyn. The leadership here in this library is firmly committed to every individual's freedom to read whatever they want. That's very solid, and people understand that, and they expect that, and they appreciate that about this library system. But other libraries and schools across the country might not have that kind of support. So what we wanted to do, we wanted to make sure that we were able to step in and support particularly young people who, again, are at the business end of some of these challenges, who walk into a seemingly safe space like a library or a school where traditionally those are spaces where everyone is welcome, everyone is encouraged to follow their curiosity and engage with ideas and identities and narratives that they might not otherwise had a chance to engage with, or explore things about their own identity in a way that's comfortable and supportive. And young people across the country are entering into these traditionally welcoming spaces, and they're seeing books that speak to them physically removed from the shelves and hidden away or destroyed. And that says to a young person who's walking into these spaces that their lives don't matter, that their identities and their narratives, their stories have no place in those communities. So what we figured out how to do is to offer access to our full digital, our ebook and audiobook collection to anyone age 13 to 21 in the United States who's facing any sort of book ban or challenge or access issue in their communities. So what we ask anyone 13 to 21, if they're experiencing any of these challenges, just to reach out to us, write us a letter, an email about what they're seeing, you know, what they're facing, any lack of support that they're experiencing in their communities. And what we do, we respond by giving them a digital library card, an e-card. And with that library card, they can access over 500,000 e-books and audiobooks from the Brooklyn Public Library collection. And it's important just to note that this isn't just about banned books. We're not, you know, saying that, you know, we'll give you an e-card and then you can read all the books that have been removed from the shelves. But we're offering this, the idea of a healthy library environment by offering them a card that gives them access to anything that they want to read. Books that are banned, but also books that they might be romance novelists. They could be, you know, science fiction titles that they're interested in. Just to let them know that this is what a library should be. It should represent a broad range of points of view and experiences that can be freely accessed, you know, unfettered and unrestricted to anyone who seeks it.
For those of you who might have just tuned in, I'm Michael Smith. I'm one of the attorneys who hosts the radio show Law and Disorder, and I'm speaking with Nick Higgins, the chief librarian at the Brooklyn Public Library. Nick, if young people want to write in to the library, how do they get a hold of you so they can get that free card?
They can certainly send us an email. What they do, they just write to booksunbanned@bklynlibrary.org. Or they can send us a message on Instagram. They can tweet at us, and we'll have a small team, a very small but mighty team of librarians who are very committed to this issue of intellectual freedom, who will respond personally to each of those requests and ask them a little bit about their situation. And you know, sometimes young people will write to us, or parents of young people who are concerned about their kids, who are walking through environments where, you know, other adults in the community are saying that they don't belong. You know, we talk to, you know, we write to these young people, these parents, and offer all the support that we can, whether that's with an e-card, so they can start checking out books that they want to read, but also anything that we can do to help surface and identify any local supports in the areas where they live, advocacy groups, other support groups, other networks that they can tap into so they don't feel so alone and isolated within these communities that are really moving against them.
And Nick, please give out that address again for those who were slow to pick up their pen.
Oh, for sure. It's booksunbanned@bklynlibrary.org. And again, this is a campaign for young people aged 13 to 21. Again, this is a free digital library card that provides access to over 500,000 ebooks and audiobooks for free for a full year. They immediately become part of the BPL, Brooklyn Public Library community. And importantly, they're also encouraged to join the broader BPL community by tuning into monthly teen intellectual freedom councils. This is a group of really dedicated and what I think are future library and community leaders that have been part of the BPL community for, you know, since childhood, but have since sort of graduated into some of the internship programs and other teen programming that we have at Brooklyn Public Library. This group has established itself as what they call themselves the Teen Intellectual Freedom Council, and they host monthly Zoom sessions where they get together not only with Brooklyn teens, but teens across the United States. and they use the opportunity to talk about access issues, library issues, freedom to read issues, talk about the things that people are seeing on the ground level, whether it's in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, or Austin, Texas, or other places in the country that might be experiencing more intense pressure to remove some books and narratives from the shelves of their libraries. And then they create this network of peer support and advice that they share among themselves. And this group has been meeting now since we began back in April of 2022. And the membership of the Brooklyn Public Library, the Books on Ban program, has been growing. And we anticipate that group of young people to continue to meet and grow and further support their peers and develop into a very powerful network to push back on these coordinated efforts to ban books in schools and libraries.
Yeah, that's quite an extraordinary report, Nick. Thank you for that good work. How many library cards have been given out so far, and how many items have been checked out?
Yeah, so we've issued over 6,000 cards to teens in every state in the country, Washington, D.C., in Puerto Rico. The checkouts from those cards come in at right around 51,000, and it continues to grow as more people learn about this program and are reaching out to us and understand the value of having full access to a collection that's unrestricted. The teens that have reached out to us reach out to us with really heartbreaking stories about how they're seeing voices silenced and they don't have a sense of belonging, and this access to literature that is affirming and helps them understand the world, themselves, and their neighbors, it's a lifeline for them. But we also have young people who are reaching out to us from rural areas in Vermont, for instance, whose only access to a public library might be an hour's drive away from their home, and they have no way to get there. So they're also part of the story. It's a story about an investment, or rather a lack of investment, in public resources like public libraries and schools to support the educational and social needs of our communities, particularly for young people.
This is Attorney Michael Smith at Law and Disorder Radio. We're speaking with the Chief Librarian, Nick Higgins, at the Brooklyn Public Library. It's the sixth largest public library in America, and they're fighting back about this book banning. Nick, I wanted to ask you a broader question. Why do you think that this book banning is occurring?
Yeah, it's an important question, and I think about it in terms of why is it happening here in the United States. We are a country that has a fierce anti-totalitarian strain that runs through everything. At least that's what we've experienced in our lifetimes, what we've experienced historically. And we've seen a shift over the past few years about power being consolidated in small groups of people who want to impose their view of the world, frankly, on the larger population of this pluralistic society that we live in and that we aspire to. So this could be a question. It's not only a question about banning books and the ideas contained within those books, but it's cut from the same cloth as conversations and pushback on the boogeyman of CRT, teaching that in schools. It's a pushback that's familiar. Pushback of Black Lives Matter protests. It's pushback on COVID restrictions and masking, election denial. So it's all part of what some people refer to as small people with big voices sort of take over the narrative and try to take over the conversation in a way that makes other people, the majority of the people who live in this country, fearful for speaking out against that, even though they don't agree with censorship efforts or denying the rights of certain individuals to live freely in the society. So, at the beginning of this conversation, we were talking about book bans, and that's what we're here to talk about today. Traditionally, a public library might counter book bans by talking about how the foundation of a public library, the foundation of democracy, is a healthy democracy, you know, requires us to engage in all points of view and ideas that we agree with and we don't agree with and that sort of thing. And that's absolutely true. But what's different about it this time is that books are a proxy, I think, for another conversation of that's being raised by these small people with big voices. They're really talking about denying the existence of actual human beings who live in our communities, silencing voices and preventing them from existing and living full lives. So it's really about, again, the concentration on people, you know, focus on people of color, LGBTQ plus communities, and trying to silence those voices and eliminating them from the conversation of public discourse. And that's, it takes on a much more sinister tone, I think, but that's really the agenda that's being advanced.
I was really impressed, because I live in Brooklyn, and my local library is about four blocks away. It's a wonderful place. And I was really impressed with everything that you folks do. And I wonder whether you could talk about that before we come to an end of our allotted time.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy that you're a library user, and look forward to seeing you in the library in person. The library provides a broad range of programs and services for the community. Of course, it is about books, but it's not just about books. It, you know, we look at the library as a space that is shared by the community. It's a space that you can walk into and you have an opportunity to sit next to someone who you might not have otherwise had a chance to sit next to and converse with. This is, you walk into a library and you see Brooklyn, you see your community. It's a very unique and increasingly rare institution that is held together by a social contract. It's, you know, we're all, no matter what our backgrounds are, whatever our abilities are, ages, whatever, we're all invited. And what we find in the library, from the books to the services to the people that we interact with, we all have a responsibility to take good care of those resources and what we find there. So the library itself, listen, I mean, we have plenty of programs beyond books. We have programs that help job seekers find employment, small business owners write business plans. We have English language classes for new Americans. We have programs in our city jail system where we roll around book carts into different areas of jails and prisons in the area. We partnered with Bard College to provide associate's degrees here at Brooklyn Public Library, where students will come to the library and use Brooklyn Public Library as their campus while they're going to school. So we like to think of the library as taking care of people from birth to old age. So from the children's story times that are always overly subscribed, to older adults programs that encourage, you know, older adults to learn formal Oxford-style debates and really puzzle out the important issues of the day, together as a community, interacting with people that you might otherwise have a chance to interact with, and building those relationships and strengthening communities in a space that's accessible and open to all.
Well, Nick Higgins, we're coming to an end of our allotted time, unfortunately, but I wanted to ask you a final question. How can people get a free library card from the Brooklyn Public Library, and how can people stay in touch with the work that you folks do?
For sure. I mean, I think that wherever your listeners are from, I encourage you all to take a much more active role in supporting institutions like libraries and schools. At the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about the pressure that schools and libraries are facing from small groups that are causing a lot of friction and a lot of noise and a lot of disruption. I encourage everyone to get involved in, if you're not already, in your school board, in supporting your libraries and institutions, and letting them know that the community broadly supports free and open access to the world's knowledge and ideas. You can always come to the Brooklyn Public Library if you live anywhere or pay taxes anywhere in New York State. You can get a Brooklyn Public Library card just by visiting one of our 60 locations here in Brooklyn, filling out a library card application, and you're on your way. If you live outside of New York State, certainly, you know, look at becoming a member of your own public libraries and supporting them at the local level. But also, if you're age 13 to 21, and you want to be part of this this effort to push back on book bans and censorship, just please reach out to us at booksunbanned@bklynlibrary.org. The important thing here, Michael, is just to show up, stay involved, and fight back.
Nick Higgins from the Brooklyn Public Library, it's been terrific having you on our show. This is Michael Smith signing off from Law and Disorder and saying goodbye and expressing my gratitude to Nick Higgins for being on the show. Nick, you take it easy.
You do the same, Michael. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So long.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Wooden ships on the water, very free and easy, easy. You know the way it's supposed to be. Silver people on the shoreline, let us be talking about very free and easy. Horror grips us as we watch you die. All we can do is echo your anguished cries, stare at all human feelings die. We are leaving, you don't need us, no.
New York City attorney and publisher Bill Schaap died in his home on February 25th after a long illness. He was 75. After graduating from the University of Chicago Law School in 1964, Schaap worked for the Center for Constitutional Rights on its project in Japan, representing anti-war GIs during the Vietnam War. For 20 years, he and his companion, the late Ellen Ray, lived in Washington, D.C., and published and wrote for the magazine Covert Action Quarterly, which exposed the crimes of the CIA. In its early years, they named CIA agents, until a Naming Names Act was passed by Congress, making the exposure of agents a crime. In the early 80s, they moved to New York City and founded Sheridan Square Press. They published books about the CIA by former agents. Most prominently, they published New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's book, On the Trail of the Assassins, showing CIA involvement in the Kennedy assassination. The book became a New York Times bestseller and was the basis for the Oliver Stone movie, JFK. In the early 90s, they founded the Institute for Media Analysis and began publishing the media criticism magazine, Lies of Our Times. Bill Schaap was a recognized expert on government propaganda and wrote and spoke widely and frequently on the topic. Michael Smith, I know that Bill was a dear friend of yours.
Yes, of mine and of Michael Ratner's, with whom he worked for about 35 years. And Bill, you know, with the Institute for Media Analysis, was the fiscal sponsor for Law and Disorder. So we owe the existence of our show partly to Bill's organization. One of the last legal things Bill did was to be the attorney for the boat to Gaza, which was bringing supplies to the Palestinians after the Israeli aerial bombardment of this open-air prison. For that, the government closed down all his banking accounts. But Bill was just amazingly courageous and smart, never got indicted for what he did. And it goes all the way back. He was in law school 2 years before I was, in 1964, at the University of Chicago, and he was representing people who were demonstrating against segregated housing on the south side of Chicago. One of those people was Bernie Sanders.
Too interesting. When Bill and Ellen started publishing Covert Action Quarterly, did they stumble on names of the CIA agents?
Yeah, I asked Bill that question. Well, they put out the magazine with their comrade Lou Wolfe. And Bill explained that Lou was able to figure out from public information who it was in the U.S. embassies abroad who were actually using their job title at the embassy as a cover, and they were really CIA agents. And he explained to me just
what clues you looked for in order to figure that out. And that's how they did it.
But I understand that before Congress passed the so-called Naming Names Act, do you think that Bill and Allen were under scrutiny by the government for their publishing?
You bet. They worked with six or eight ex-CIA agents who wrote expose books on the nefarious and illegal activities of the CIA. I think Ralph McGehee wrote one of the first books, and at that time the CIA said he was the public enemy number one. So Bill and Ellen were definitely under scrutiny.
Michael, the body of work that Bill and Ellen were responsible for, in its totality, they were kind of the Edward Snowdens of that time.
That's a good
in
analogy,
exposing,
Heidi.
Yeah, CIA, FBI corruption.
Bill tells the story. We had the good fortune of interviewing him last year. So why don't we play that interview for our listeners? Attorney Bill Shapp graduated from law school at the University of Chicago in 1964 and has been practicing law ever since. Bill specialized in military law initially, practicing in both Okinawa and then in Germany. He later became the editor-in-chief of the Military Law Reporter in Washington for a number of years. In the 70s and 80s, he was staff counsel at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City. In the late 80s, he was an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, where he taught courses on propaganda and disinformation. In addition to being a practicing lawyer, Bill was a journalist, publisher, and a writer specializing in intelligence as it relates to the media. He was the co-publisher of the great magazine Covert Action Quarterly for more than 20 years. He also published a magazine on propaganda and disinformation called Lies of Our Times. Bill Shapp has written many articles and edited a number of books on the topic of media and intelligence. He joins us today on Lawyers You'll Like to discuss his work as a lawyer and a writer. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Bill, how does a high school guy from Freeport, Long Island, who goes to the University of Chicago and gets a job at a Wall Street firm, how does he end up doing movement political work? What was it that got you started on the that road?
Well, it was fairly quick and fairly direct. One of the first big cases I worked on at this Wall Street firm, they had some outside counsel working on it, one of whom was Dave Lubell. And Dave Lubell, who had, I think, been a recruiter for the Communist Party in his youth, was always good at spotting somebody who might be worth recruiting. And he started to tell me that there was a convention of this lawyers group coming up. And I said, I really don't like lawyers groups. And he said, you'll like this one. And it was the 1967 Lawyers Guild Convention in New York. He dragged me to one event, and I met Bill Kunstler, I met Arthur Kanoy, and I met Victor Rabinowitz and all the old-timers, and I'd been on Wall Street for a year, and I said, I didn't even know there were lawyers like this. So I joined the same day, met Bernadine Dorn, and a few weeks later, she called me and said, we need your help. And I said, what do you need my help for? She said, you got to defend a bunch of Columbia students. And I said, what'd they do? She said, well, they're protesting a gymnasium. They're trying to tear down the fence. I said, What's wrong with the gymnasium? She said, you don't understand. I'll explain it to you. So, of course, Columbia was taking over half of Morningside Park, trying to turn it into a Columbia student gymnasium, not a people's gymnasium. The next thing I knew, the whole riot started at Columbia. And she said, as soon as they start arresting people, you're going to have to go down and defend them. And I said, I've never done that. And she said, it'll be very easy. And shortly before the arrests happened, I went to the December 10th dinner, I guess it was ECLC.
That's the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee.
So I was sitting at a
table.
And
they were set up in part because the ACLU would not defend the Communist Party.
That's
and
right.
the dissidents
right.
in the Communist
right.
Party.
Leonard Boudin was their chief the counsel.
Yeah. So I went, this was my first legal political thing I went to, and I was sitting at a table with Bill Kunstler and Arthur Kanoy and Victor Rabinowitz and a few other people like that. And somebody comes rushing in and says, we just got a phone call. A bunch of people got busted at a demonstration protesting a speech by Hubert Humphrey. He was Lyndon Johnson's vice president, and he was thinking of running for president.
And he supported the war against the Vietnamese.
He was everything bad about the word liberal is what he was. He was a liberal warmonger. So in any event, they went around the table, and all of a sudden I noticed everybody's looking at me. Because Consley, it was, you know, it was 11 o'clock at night. Consley didn't want to run down to night court, and Kanoy didn't want to run down to night court. And I'm like the youngest one at the table, and I've been practicing law for a couple of years. And they said, go on, do it. And I said, I don't even know what an arraignment is. And Consley said, it's easy. Let me tell you, go down there. The first thing you do is make friends with the clerk. Because if you're ever doing criminal law, make friends with the clerk. Go in the back, fill out all the little notices in advance, sign your name on 50 pieces of paper, and give them to them. So I go there. All these people got arrested protesting a speech by Hubert Humphrey. And I'm looking at the list, and one of the people on this list of like 30 or 40 defendants was Paul Krasner, who was sort of a friend I knew from before. I said, oh, boy, because I looked into the audience, and there were like 200 people there, and it's, you know, it's midnight. And I said, what the two? How many? And they were all, almost all of them were Krasner's friends. The word had gotten out that he'd been busted. He was in jail. And
Krasner at the time was the editor of the great magazine, The Realist.
The Realist,
which
yeah.
was a political satire magazine.
Very, very well known and very clever, smart guy. So I said, hope he doesn't, you know, come to way near the end. I've never done this before. And then they call the first case, and it's Krasner. And he comes up there, and everybody in the audience jumps up and starts screaming and yelling and cheering. And the judge says, clear the courtroom, clear the courtroom. Get rid of them all. Get them all out of here. And there were about seven or eight elderly black women in the back row who were there for their sons or husbands or whatever, who were just ordinary criminal cases. And they said, not us, Your Honor. We don't know this guy. We don't have anything to do with him. And he said, all right, the old ladies in the back row can stay. Everybody else get out of the courtroom. And so they call the first case, and it's Paul, and he's standing next to me. And he said, I'm going to get life. And I said, no, it's disorderly conduct. I don't think you're going to get life. And I said, what happened? He said, well, they told me I could have not been arrested if I said I was there as a journalist, but I, out of solidarity, I refused to do that. So I came up with everybody. He said, but I had a big problem with the arresting officer who really wants to throw the book at me. I said, why is that? He said, well, they have this new thing now. Since at mass arrests, one officer would be assigned like 30 or 40 people, and he'd never remember who was who. And when you'd go in for a first court appearance, you'd keep your client back sitting with like five other people and say, all right, officer, so which one of them is the guy you arrested? And he would have no idea. So they started taking Polaroid pictures of the arresting officer standing next to the defendant. So he'd have them with him in his pocket to look and make sure he knew. And Paul said, so when they put us together for the Polaroid picture, I turned to the guy and said, where are we going after the prom, sweetie? And he said, and the guy went ballistic. So
we're talking to Bill Schaap, lawyers you'll like. Bill is talking about his beginnings as a movement lawyer in the 60s. We just talked about Paul Krasner, political satirist that Bill was defending in court.
Okay, so Bill, eventually you ended up going to Okinawa defending soldiers in the anti-war movement, and then also, I think, in Germany. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was I was hanging out at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and I was there one afternoon, and we had just decided that morning that Lubell, Fine & Schaap was going to fold.
That was a law firm you went to after Wall Street.
Right, and we discovered that having no paying clients would lead to bankruptcy. Sure as... So I said, what am I going to do? And I hear a voice from over a cubicle, and it was Greg Finger. He said, you want to go to Okinawa?
Greg Finger was, I think at that time, administrative director right. of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I said, well, I'm open for anything. I said, this for me and Ellen? She said, yeah, we got jobs for both of you. And the next thing I know, a few days later, I was signed up to be a staff counsel on the Lawyers Guild project, military law project in Okinawa.
And Ellen Ray, of course, is your companion, and you and Ellen,
she was
head out to the east.
She was quickly nicknamed Della Street by the military judges. And we spent the next 4 years doing military law all over the world. That was what got us really interested in international stuff. When we first went over there, we didn't even know what the CIA was, and most people in America didn't know what the CIA was. We're talking like 71, 72. This is long before the Church Committee reports, or several years. And when you work overseas in that kind of a climate with the military, and you learn a lot fast about American imperialism. And then once you learn that, you learn about the CIA. And that led us to, when we finally got back, deciding to work on originally on Counter Spy magazine and then on Covert Action magazine.
I was a subscriber to Covert Action Quarterly, as was Michael Ratner, a great magazine. What was the purpose of the magazine? Because now you're wearing a journalist editor hat. And what did you try to accomplish with the magazine?
Let's just note that Bill was co-publisher of Covert Action for nearly 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. We started it on a shoestring, and the original purpose was just to expose the CIA. We worked with Lou Wolfe, who was an expert at uncovering CIA agents in U.S. embassies, not through any classified documents, but because if you knew how to read the paperwork and State Department things, you could tell who were the ringers, and you knew these people were CIA. And we were so successful that Congress passed a law against us.
Let's stay up. Let's go too fast, because the magazine, it was a really famous and well-known magazine, and there's still people who look at it as this is the highest level of American journalism, what this magazine was doing. And there was a number of years when there were actually incredible lists of CIA people who were disrupting the politics of other countries that you guys published. So talk about that for a minute as to what your goal was, and then the struggle over when they tried to outlaw you.
Yeah, our goal really was to try and make these people ineffective, because the only way most CIA case officers could work, particularly the ones that were assigned to an embassy, was to have to pretend to be something else. They were all, you know, third assistant political secretaries, second assistant, whatever, and those were all phony things. And their job was to inveigle their way into various community organizations in whatever foreign capital they might have been posted, to recruit people to turn against their own countries, be traitors to their own countries, and become spies for the U.S. So we thought that if we identify these people beforehand, it might make their job a little harder, which it did. Of course, the problem was the government said we were trying to get them killed, which we weren't trying to do, and nobody we exposed ever did get killed. But they were very fortunate that one CIA station chief in Athens named Richard Welch was exposed by a Greek group and assassinated. And for a long time, everybody, including President Gerald Ford, tried to say that he got assassinated because we exposed him. And in fact, we hadn't. We later, with the help of Mort Halperin, who had connections to the State Department, discovered cables where Welch had been warned not to move into his predecessor's house in Athens, because everybody in Athens knew that was where the CIA chief of station lived. And we found a cable he sent back, said, "I'm sorry, my wife really likes the house. We're going to move in." And they moved in, and like 3 days later, he was gunned down on the front steps.
Now, they tried to pin that on you guys for a long time.
They did. Well, Gerald Ford said it directly.
It's still, when you read stuff, it's still like one of the incidents they point to. There's someone you haven't mentioned yet. I'm interested in what his role was. And Phil Agee is dead now, but he published a book called Inside the Company, which exposed the names of hundreds of agents subverting democracy and unionization in Latin America and Central America. Now, he had some relationship to the magazine, or?
No, we founded it with him. He had been an advisor to Counter Spy. Counter Spy folded when Welch got killed because of the pressure was too much, and we started the new one called Covert Action, and we worked with Phil directly the whole time. He was not the person who was discovering who the undercover people were. Lou Wolfe was doing that. But Phil wrote articles for us in every issue, and we worked very closely with him. And in fact, some of us traveled around the world when he was asked to go to various places to try to expose CIA operations, the most well-known being Jamaica, when the CIA was trying to overthrow the government of Michael Manley. And the government asked Phil Agee to come down and help, and Phil asked Ellen Ray to come down and help them. And once you start exposing these things, they really don't have any defense.
Were you harassed yourself, and was Covert Action infiltrated or attempts to close the paper down, the magazine down?
So far as we know, we weren't infiltrated because it was just the three of us. We didn't have a big. We did everything. I mean, we waxed the galleys. We rolled them down with them. We did everything. So they couldn't actually infiltrate the organization, but they certainly did try to catch us in something phony. We would get tips that turned out to be CIA trying to get us to print some story that wasn't true so they could then discredit us. No, we actually had more direct interference from the government when we were doing the military law work before covert action. The military is always a bit more heavy-handed than the CIA, and they would plant bugs in our attic and in Okinawa and things like that. But they didn't know we were very close to a lot of MPs, and they used to bring us the transcripts and show us that they were recording everything that was going on at the legal counseling. And I ended up getting 100 court-martial convictions thrown out because they were eavesdropping the defense attorney. And if you proved the defense attorney was being eavesdropped, you won the case.
One more question on the magazine, Bill. There was a point where after you'd published the names of CIA agents for many years, that they passed a law. It was really, you would have to call it the Covert Action Information Bulletin Law, because it was passed to stop your work, which was all taken from public sources. So tell us what that law is and what's been its sort of history as we've gone forward.
It's only been used a few times. It was, it's called the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, and there are two parts. One makes it a crime for someone who is in the government, has classified information, to reveal someone's identity. But the second part makes it a crime to reveal the identity of someone that you did not learn from classified information or from your position, but if, and this was the tricky, they put in word, but if you were in the business of exposing these kind of people. And we actually, at one point, Floyd Abrams had gone down to Washington on behalf of AP, CBS, and the New York Times to protest the law, and then he came back and he said, nobody has to worry. They're only interested in getting Covert Action magazine.
Bill, you published a book long before I ever met you, a book that I bought and read and cherished, about Jim Garrison, the district attorney in New Orleans, who investigated the Kennedy assassination. Tell us what was behind that, because it was quite an extraordinary thing when you published that book.
Yeah, it was mostly due to the fact that Ellen Ray had known Jim back when he was investigating Clay Shaw, and she had actually gone down to New Orleans in 67 and 68 and been one of his clack of supporters. But then we got a call from Mary Howell, the guild lawyer in New Orleans. She was a friend of Jim Garrison's, and she said he had a manuscript and he had a publisher, but the publisher had rejected it. They thought it was a little too outré. And we went down to meet with him in Ellen and said, oh, Jim Garrison, my idol. I'd love. And the problem was that he had written the book in the third person, and it was obvious that the book should be written in the first person. So we had to go out. We hired Zach Sklar, who was a great editor at the time, and we redid the book, and it became JFK, and it was a bestseller. And we were in Havana. He doesn't admit this, Oliver Stone, but we met him in Havana.
Yeah, I heard that during cornered him in an elevator.
Right, during the film festival, and she said, have I got a property for you? Because we knew he was an assassination freak, and we gave him an advance copy of the book. And like that same night, he called and said, it's really very interesting. I can't do anything with it, but it's really very interesting. And the next day, he called and said, listen, it's really very interesting. Don't sell it to anybody else. And then the third day, he called and said, I want to buy it, but you have to keep it top secret until I do the film, and we did, and he made a hell of a film.
Well, Zach Sklar wrote the screenplay with Oliver.
Right.
It was a hell of a film. It's coming out again, you know, on the 50th anniversary.
Right, I think
of
they're
the
doing
Kennedy
a director's
assassination.
Cut.
In a nutshell, what would you say the message of that film was?
Well, I think there may be a couple of little things that are off, but basically I think Garrison had the scenario down better than any of the other writers about the Kennedy assassination. And he had down about the involvement of the Cuban exiles, the involvement of the CIA, the involvement of some military people. It's not something you can explain in 1 minute, but everybody that's been written about it agrees that Oswald was a patsy, just like he said, and that it was rogue elements of the government and the CIA that were involved. There are Cuban exiles all over the place now. I mean, New Orleans and Dallas and the whole Gulf Coast was filled with Cuban exiles in those days.
You published a newsletter called Lies of Our Times, and it was aimed at the newspaper that prints everything that's fit, the New York Times. But more generally, it was a device to expose government disinformation and propaganda. And I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, that was in the 80s or 90s, Bill?
It was in the 90s, from 1990 to 1995, I think. We did 6 years of it. It was, to a certain extent, the abuses we were crying about got a little bit less over time, because that sometimes is the helpful result of this kind of exposure. But we were just tired with people thinking that if it was in the New York Times, it must be true, or if Dan Rather said it, it must be true, or whatever. And the fact is, those people lie all the time if it suits their people's needs. So we had a great run. We had Noam Chomsky did a regular column every issue for us, and we had a lot of really good writers from all over the world, mostly from the States, explaining how stories that had become gospel were really completely untrue.
Bill, you've taught courses on propaganda and disinformation at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and you've been in the field for decades. How do you comment on the American people's response to recent revelations of the ubiquitous surveillance state and really a secret government? Have things changed for the better or the worse in terms of public awareness and response?
I think they've changed a bit for the better. We're still way behind Europe, where the average European is skeptical of anything its government says, and that's not so much the case here. But I think we've gotten to a point where people recognize that the government lies to them. They recognize that there's an awful lot that goes on that they don't know very much about. It's a big step up from in the 60s and 70s. Most Americans had no idea what was good. They didn't know what the NSA was. The NSA was secret. They barely knew what the CIA was. And they had no idea that all that stuff was going on. Nor did they have any notion of the degree to which the government had influence in the media, particularly the foreign media. I mean, that was one of the CIA's best operations, was to control journalists all over the world. Including American journalists, but sometimes you didn't even have to, because you could plant a story with an agent in Germany, and then Reuters would pick it up, and then AP would pick it up, and then the story that the CIA guy wrote would be in the front page of the American papers without anybody publishing it being aware of that.
Bill, you started the Institute for Media Analysis to try to give a boost to people that were doing the kind of thing that you and Ellen had been doing all those years. Tell us about that.
Well, we set up, we actually got nonprofit tax-exempt status fairly quickly, which was a little bit surprising. Mel Wolf was representing us at the time. I didn't want to represent myself. And originally, the government tried to deny the application, and they sent him a letter saying, what political party does Ed Herman belong to? What political party does Bill Shapp and Ellen Ray belong to? And he sent them back this scathing thing as the director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, blah, 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 blah. And they just backed off and immediately granted it. Now, it's funny, because there's all this talk going on now about the Obama administration and the IRS vamping on the Tea Party organizations that want to get tax exemption. Well, in the Reagan years, and the IRS was vamping on the left-wing groups exactly the same. I mean, it's the notion that the IRS is completely divorced from the administration power is nonsense. People, I mean, there may be a few Korea people, but a lot of people come in each time there's a new administration who think the way that administration thinks. But anyway, Mel's letter did the trick, and we got the tax exemption. And then we started, we were publishing pamphlets in the beginning that people were writing for us, some by Phil Agee. We did one by Edgar Chamorro about the role of the CIA and the Contras in Nicaragua, one by Carl Ginsburg about the Moynihan Report and racism. And then we started the magazine and The Lies of Our Times, and we started doing books. We actually published half a dozen books, although book publishing is much harder than magazine publishing. It's a much bigger investment. And since we were, by definition, not publishing things that we expected to be bestsellers, it was a little risky to begin with.
There were a couple of books I remember. They were great. One was, and I think the first one you did, was called White Paper, White Wash.
Right.
And it was by Phil Agee. And at that time, the U.S. government had issued a series of documents trying to show, was it Cuban or Russian support for the El Salvador insurgents, the revolutionaries. And Phil just What did he do?
Well, he just I mean, he went through it and he showed how every one of these things were a lie and some of the documents were forgeries. The whole white paper was a scam. One of the greatest things about even the naming names columns and stuff is that we were doing this stuff and we didn't get killed. And that was a very helpful example for other people because people constantly would ask us, how come you haven't been assassinated?
The column is called Naming Names.
Right. And Phil would say, I don't think they want to make martyrs out of us. Because people always ask Phil Agee why the CIA hadn't assassinated him. And
he couldn't live here, though. He had to go live in Cuba.
Well, for a long time. But we also discovered when Mel was doing Freedom of Information.
That's Mel Wolf, who's a former legal director for the ACLU.
Yeah, he did Phil's Freedom of Information Acts, and we discovered documents that at least showed that there was a big CIA Justice Department meeting about assassinating him. And it was then sort of covered up, and it came out stuck in a bunch of FOIA stuff. And we went to the judge in the case to try and get more, because these were obviously got in there by accident. The judge said, I'm going to look at this stuff in camera. And after he looked at it in camera, he said, well, I've looked at it, and you ain't going to get it.
when we think about that, it would surprise me if they hadn't at least had that kind of meeting about Ed Snowden, whether he should be killed. I think they probably came out, he shouldn't be, for maybe political reasons, but also because there may be stuff that he's given to other people all over the world and that they don't have access to.
I wanted to ask Bill what advice you would have for young attorneys considering a progressive practice who may be frightened by government tactics.
The fact of the matter is that you, as we know from Lawyers Guild people all over the country, you can be a politically active, politically conscious lawyer and still make a living. You're not going to be like a Wall Street tycoon, but there are a large chunk of the American people who are progressive, and most of them, when they have legal stuff, they'd rather have a progressive lawyer. It doesn't mean you have to defend them against some, big criminal case. Progressive people want a progressive lawyer to do their will or buy their house or do their whatever. And I don't necessarily encourage progressives to become lawyers, but I do encourage lawyers to become progressives.
On that note, Bill, it's been an astounding career. It really taking on the state, imperialism, the CIA, and one that had plenty of risks with it. So thank you from all of us.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on Law & Disorder. You are truly a lawyer you'll like.
Thanks.
Bill Schaap and his companion Ellen Ray, along with Lou Wolf and Phil Agee, with the help of our own Michael Ratner, launched Covert Action magazine years ago to expose the crimes of the CIA. And we're happy to know that Covert Action magazine is back in business. You can get a hold of it on the internet. Covert Action.